A cry of pain echoed through the walls of stone, followed by a prayer, a plea. "I want to get out of here," a voice full of moisture quietly said. "If I wasn't so fat, you could pull me out of here," the voice came again. "Nah, we'll get you out," a strong voice replied. "And when we do, I'll be your workout partner." And then a shift, a collapse, and both men were rocked with pain. One could retreat, and the other found himself wedged in a pit of rock and despair. The rock, too weak to hold the rescue rigs needed to pull him from a definite grave, closed, coiled, and refused to loosen its grip. Engulfed in rock and unable to move, horrors unfolded themselves as dozens of rescuers tried to free one man. And in the end, despite their best efforts, this one man would forever be entombed. Welcome back to Tragedy with a View. First, I want to say that the audio of this episode is going to sound a little bit weird in some parts. If you listened to our last episode, you will know that I was having a little bit of microphone issues, and those little issues turned into really big issues, and then they just kind of kept rolling. And so kind of piecing together the audio on this particular episode, but I now know how to move forward and the best way to move forward. So at least you know this is going to be the last one, hopefully for the time being, where the audio gets a little bit spotty in some points. Hello, I am your host, Kayla, and I am here with my friend, Anne, today.
Hello.
And we're gonna get uncomfortable.
This is one of those situations that I just don't think I'll ever find myself in, because the thought of climbing through a very narrow cave underground just...
On purpose? No, absolutely not. This is the last episode of 2023.
Woohoo.
And this is releasing on December 27th, so we're through the holidays, I think.
When is Boxing Day? Is that after?
December 26th.
Perfect. Already passed.
Yeah. So we're through the holidays. If you've already done all of your celebrating, I hope you enjoyed. If you haven't gotten everything done yet, I hope you enjoy in the days to come. I hope you're ready for this episode. If you're claustrophobic like me, I'm so sorry. Your heart rate is probably...
My heart rate's already up.
Yeah, it's going to get a little erratic, and I'm going to start by telling you a kind of comical story of what I think is what triggered my claustrophobia. And as a child, did you ever roll up in rugs?
I can't say that I have. Blankets, yes. I wasn't ready for rugs.
I told Sam this, and he was like... What? And I was like, no, this is a normal thing. This is a normal thing that kids do. So, yeah. And he was just like, no, it's not. So as a child, my brother and my cousins, we would roll each other up in rugs, and we could always just kind of like turn on our own and get out. And one time, I was like rolled up, shoulders down, and I was rolled up just a little bit too tight, and I couldn't unroll. I couldn't move. I was stuck, and nobody else was really paying attention at the time. And so I was like trying to like thrash around and get myself free, and I couldn't.
Oh.
So now even if I'm in tight spaces, it's just bad.
Can you even like roll up in blankets now?
No.
Burrito yourself?
I need to have like open space, or my legs or my arms need to be free.
Okay.
Sometimes I will wrap the blanket around my legs, but even when I do, I just
laying on top.
Yeah. Yeah, I just can't do it.
Yeah, that would be traumatizing.
Yeah.
How old were you?
Pre-7. It was before I started riding horses, which was for my 7th birthday.
Formative years. Traumatizing formative years.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know where mine stems from, if I'm honest. Like, because I don't have a claustrophobic fear, I guess. But it's almost like a fear of being trapped. I just don't want to be somewhere that I can't get out of.
I think that's a pretty common thing.
Yeah.
It's like the fear of heights. It's not truly a fear of heights. It's just your natural instinct trying to keep you alive.
Yeah. Which my Sam would say that it's not a fear of heights. It's a fear of falling from those heights.
Yeah, okay.
Also, listeners, just to clarify, Anne's husband's name is Sam. Clearly different Sam. But if she says Sam, she's probably referring to her Sam. If I say Sam, I'm probably referring to mine. So I know that can probably get confusing.
I love that they have the same first and middle name.
They do. Yeah.
The Nutty Putty Cave, located about 55 miles south of Salt Lake City and west of Utah Lake, is a hydrothermal cave that was first found and explored in 1960 by Dale Green, who gave the cave its name. It was made up of a clay-like material that coated most of the walls, which is why it got its name, because the clay seemed to ooze from the walls almost like peanut butter. And this also reminded Dale of Silly Putty.
Oh, interesting. Silly Putty Cave.
This clay and even some more of the solid walls would begin to turn pliable if you pressed too hard against them.
Mm.
And at this time, the explanation for this odd texture was found when an analysis was completed showing that the main component of the ground was actually the same makeup as sand, just in smaller particles.
Huh.
Okay, so I'm going to show you a photo that's good for showing you what the ground looks like. Listeners, this photo and more will be on social media for you to look at and view. And also, just as a warning, this is just some legs sticking up out of a hole.
Oh. There's nothing in me that thinks that that's a good idea.
I'm with you.
That's a very small space. Is that one of the hikers that was stuck? It's a caver.
I don't know that this was someone who got stuck or if it was a rescuer. It kind of looks like it might have been someone who got stuck, but I don't know if it was this incident that we're talking about in this story or a prior one.
Was just exploring.
And I don't know if someone in the cave was taking photos.
Well, it did say that there was like 100 rescuers there, so maybe one person snapped photos for analysis.
Nearly all caves are formed in limestone that is eaten away from acidic groundwater, which creates caves and caverns as the water flows down from the surface of the earth. The Nutty Putty, however, was formed from hydrothermic activity, so the acidic superheated water was pushed up through the crust of the earth, which I think just kind of affects the texture of the walls inside of the cave. Maybe not. I'm never going into a cave, so I can't speak from experience.
Yeah, my only experience with caves are like the family tourist caves that you can go in, you know, in Ohio, where they're very
open.
Yeah, open and have tour guides and
yeah, you're not getting lost.
Not getting lost.
The cave has a 6-foot-wide entrance called the blowhole that immediately drops down 15 feet. And from there, you can go down the big slide, which is to the right, and this opens up toward a large cavern that you can kind of congregate in, or you can go to the left into a section of the cave called the maze.
Okay. The 6-foot opening to the big slide into a large area sounds fun. But I think the fun for me might stop there.
Yeah. Well, so I think it's interesting because you think of people climbing a mountain, and climbing up is great. And, you know, you're excited and you're energized and you want to get to the top.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to come back down, and it's the opposite with caving. You go in, but then you also have to come back out. And I think that's the more dangerous part of the experience, partially because you're tired and you might just become a little bit more careless with what you're doing and almost try to rush it a little bit.
It'd be interesting to know a caver's opinion on which one is more difficult. Because, like, for hiking, I like to hike up mountains. I don't like to hike down them.
Going down sucks.
It does. I remember the first time I hiked down a hill, my IT bands were so on fire
mm-hmm.
by, like, day two. Because, you know, it takes you, like, 2 days to get up it.
Yeah.
And so you have to do the 2 days back down.
Yes.
By the end of day two, my IT bands were on fire from coming down.
Yeah.
And so that just might have been, like, my walking pattern or, you know, not training downhill or something. But
yeah.
It was spicy. So I feel like it would be opposite in a cave. Maybe.
Maybe.
Because, like, if you could slide down something, that's probably a lot easier than having to muck back out, especially in the Nutty Putty Cave. That consistency, trying to go upwards, that would be a little rough.
That would be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
The cave has several narrow and tight passages that twist and turn as you work your way through this well-laid-out cave. It contains several passages that the names of them are the Birth Canal, the Aorta Crawl, Scout Eater, and, as I've already said, the Maze. The cave runs a total of 1,355 feet long and only went 145 feet deep. And I say only because in terms of underground caves, this is pretty shallow. It was considered a good cave for first timers and intermediate cavers and regularly had over 5,000 visits per year. The description of what you would encounter in the cave included the ability to climb, crawl, and scramble, which required the use of both of your hands. And also that it's nearly impossible to get lost in, so feel free to explore.
Nearly.
Boy Scouts were frequently led through the cave system, and many entered with just a flashlight and sandals. The cave maintained a comfortable 55 degrees Fahrenheit or 12 degrees Celsius all year round and was mapped last in 2003.
Did it have to get remapped because things changed? Or, like, did passages collapse? Or was there a reason why it was remapped? Or if they tried to block off some of these ones where people didn't make it out?
Because of the cave's popularity, the walls were, there was excessive smoothing to the walls and the different features inside of the cave, which changes the layout a bit. The land was owned by the Utah School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration, but the Tipinagros Grotto took over management of the cave system in 2006, as they were the local branch of the National Speleological Society.
Nice.
This cave, while rated as good for beginners, was no stranger to rescues. In 1999, Chris Hale and Chris Morrow, both 17, got stuck in the birth canal for about 12 hours before being freed by rescuers. In 2001, two 13-year-old boys, they were Boy Scouts, also got trapped in the birth canal for about 4 hours. And then in 2004, there were two more different incidences that occurred a week apart where these individuals got stuck and nearly lost their lives in Ed's Push, which is a passage that doesn't lead to anywhere.
Oh, no.
The first in 2004 was 16-year-old Brock Clark, standing 5'7" and weighing 140 pounds, and he was freed from the cave after an intricate system of pulleys were installed. It took rescuers 14 hours to free him. He was in Ed's Push and had wiggled his way down into an almost vertical shaft, and in an effort to turn around, his left leg got bent behind him, and he just kind of got wedged in and couldn't move. Rescuers stated that he needed to be wiggled, pulled, and pushed a millimeter at a time. Brock ended up spending several days in the hospital because of the fatigue and loss of circulation his body experienced.
Oh my gosh.
The second of the 2004 incidents was with David Crowther, who was 23 and a student at Brigham Young University, who got stuck for about 10 hours. And after these incidents, the cave was closed. In May of 2009, the Tipinagos Grotto signed a cave management plan into action, which reopened the Nutty Putty. An online booking system was set up and only allowed one group at a time in. It also only allowed daytime access, and the cave was locked at night with a padlock. And I want you to put a pin in that. We're going to come back to this.
I'm glad that they actually, you know, put in some type of booking system, because if these tunnels are so narrow, I wouldn't want somebody coming in behind me. That would minimize my ability to actually get out.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I would want to at least trust the people that are in the cave with me. You can get to, hopefully there's some point in the cave that you can at least get out and wait for the next people behind you and then venture down another tunnel or something. Have some type of buddy system.
At 26 years old, John Edward Jones had a good life. Growing up in Utah, his father took him and his five brothers and two sisters caving all over the state, but they had never been to the Nutty Putty Cave. John was living in Virginia with his wife, Emily, one-year-old daughter, Lizzie,
yes,
and soon-to-be-born son. He was going to school to become a pediatric cardiologist. John and Emily had been married for 3.5 years. Prior to actually getting married, both John and Emily, who were extremely ambitious people, thought that marriage was too much work, so they had no intentions of getting married. Emily started planning to serve on a church mission trip to Madagascar, and for whatever reason, this caused John to be like, yeah, I need to marry her. One day at the Joseph Saint Memorial Building, located in Salt Lake City, Utah, John filled the top of the area with rose petals and kind of forced all of the other visitors to leave. Once Emily arrived, he played her a song that he had written on his guitar and then proposed. Emily originally said yes, but then gave him the ring back and waited 2 months until she was sure and said yes. They got married, and pretty quickly after was when they found out that she was pregnant. And this is, again, what spurred John into committing their life together. And this is why he ended up in Virginia, because that is where her family was located, and he wanted her to be close to her family as she transitioned into motherhood.
They sound like a cool couple. I'd definitely be friends with her. That's something that I would do.
Yeah.
Be like, yes? No. Let me think about it. Okay, give it back.
In 2009, the Nutty Putty Cave was reopened with strict rules about who, how, and when you could enter the cave. John and his family collected in Utah at his parents' home to celebrate Thanksgiving, and John and his younger brother, who was 23 at the time, decided to go with a group of 9 friends to the Nutty Putty Cave to do some exploring. While he had grown up exploring caves with his father, he hadn't gone in one since reaching adulthood. They arrived at about 8 p.m. and quickly started to explore the cave, sliding down the entrance and going right for the big slide, which is also the largest section of the cave.
Can we talk about the fact that they started at 8 o'clock at night?
Yeah, remember when I said put a pin in that? If they only allowed daytime access, why are they going in at 8 p.m.?
Was it still daylight? What time of year was this?
It was the end of November. This was a couple days before Thanksgiving.
I mean, I've never been to Utah, so I don't know what the end of November is like as far as weather.
I've only been to Utah in August, so I can't speak on the daylight.
But I can't imagine that there was daylight at 8 p.m. in November.
I can't either.
So they probably shouldn't have even been in there.
No, especially if it was locked at night. I don't know if they had a special permit or
they were doing some type of night cave promotion or something.
They just like knew someone who could get them in. I don't know what those details are, but they did enter at 8 p.m.
Okay.
From the big slide, John and Josh and 2 other friends who also had not been to the Nutty Putty Cave before heard about the birth canal and decided they wanted to check it out. John was very confident in his abilities, so he decided to lead the group. He entered into the passageway head first, and he wiggled his way through, knowing that towards the end of the passage, it would open up into another kind of roomy area, but not quite as large as the first room. But it was still large enough that they would be able to gather there. While inching forward in a minuscule army crawl, wiggling his hips, stomach, and fingers, John started to get concerned when the passage did not open up and it just kept getting tighter and tighter. And eventually he noticed that there was a little lip in the tunnel and it seemed to disappear down. So he crawled through headfirst in an attempt to find more room to turn around. And that's when he realized that this tunnel did not open up into anything. It just kept getting tighter and tighter. And
he was in the wrong tunnel.
That's when he knew that he was in the wrong tunnel.
Oh.
At this point, John was in part of the passage that was angled at a 70-degree downward slope called Ed's Push, and he was completely stuck. He was not able to wiggle his way backwards at all because this section of tunnel was only 10 inches wide and 14 inches high.
I'm having so much anxiety at this part of the story. Because, I mean, putting yourself in this guy's shoes, that moment of realization that you're not in the right spot.
Yeah.
And you're actually in a tunnel where previously how many other people have been rescued from Ed's Push at this point?
Yeah, and that's only including the people who needed someone to come rescue them. That's not including all of the people who were able to self-rescue.
So I don't think I asked this question. Does Ed's Push actually go somewhere?
No.
That's the one that dead ends?
Yes.
Gracious. Terrifying.
Somewhere in my research, I saw that the 10 by 14 inch size is approximately the size of a dryer opening, which I actually think dryer openings are larger than that. I don't know what dryer they're looking at, but I would feel comfortable if, you know, I wasn't actually going into a dryer, but like it was open on the other side. I would feel comfortable being able to fit through a dryer opening sized hole. 10 by 14 inches, I would look at that and be like, no way. No way.
This might be a dumb question, but how would they measure that? Is it to the actual surface tension of like where the clay is, or do they count like you can still move through the clay and it's like the harder wall?
I think it's the surface of the clay, so there's some movement to it, but not a lot.
Okay.
With John being 6 foot and 200 pounds, he was really working hard to be able to fit into this channel that he had found himself in. And at one point, to wiggle through a section, he sucked in his breath so hard that his chest and ribs kind of collapsed in. And then when he got through what he thought was the tight part, he inhaled and it allowed everything to expand. And this is what really got him wedged.
Oh, no. I mean, just based off of the description, that one arm was pinned behind him and one was pinned under him.
Yeah.
There's no space in there. And I imagine in a small space, if you start to panic at all, kind of like what you were saying, he like took a deep breath in order to get himself wedged and then his chest expanded. Mm-hmm. Well, he just filled that cavity.
Yeah, and me sitting here in this open room kind of thinking about being in a small space, I can like feel myself wanting to expand and I'm holding tension in my shoulders and my chest and my ribs and I'm just trying to take up space. And I'm sure if you're in it, you have the same psychological, physical reaction, and letting that go and getting small is so hard. His brother, Josh, was the first to figure out that John was stuck, who tried to grab John's ankles and pull him back, but because the passage was so tight, he couldn't get John to budge. After a few minutes of this, they agreed that Josh would need to leave John and call for help. John was stuck nearly upside down with one arm pinned underneath him and the other one being forced backwards. Only his navy and black tennis shoes were exposed out of that downward sloped passage, but because of the shape of the tunnel they were in, there wasn't a whole lot of room for someone to be able to pull or maneuver him. I don't know what happened to the friends at this point. I don't know where they are.
Well, how long is Ed's push? So I'm wondering, are they even in the tunnel at this point, or did John get in first, Josh was behind him, and the two friends were waiting for...
I'm not sure. Yeah, they might have done like a verbal communication of like, okay, I'm through, next person. And then, I don't know, maybe they heard John struggling, and that's when Josh made the decision to investigate.
Yeah, because I wonder how much verbal communication they actually had during this.
Once they were with each other in, like, the same place in the cave, they were able to have conversations.
So Josh could actually talk to John while he was stuck?
Yes. While he was waiting for someone to come back to him, John tried to wiggle himself backwards, and his headlamp fell from his head, so now he couldn't even see around him.
Uh-uh.
The first person to arrive to help them out was a woman named Susan Montola, or Susie, who was a local rescue volunteer, and she had extensive cave exploration experience. She arrived sometime around midnight, which meant that John had been trapped for over 3 hours by the time that she arrived. She tied ropes around her ankles so that if she got stuck, she would be able to be pulled out, and it took her 30 minutes from entering the cave to get to the cavern where the passage John was stuck in started at, and then another 20 minutes to be able to reach John. So from cave opening to where John is stuck, it took almost an hour to get there.
So we're almost at 1 a.m. here.
Yep. The first thing she did when she reached him was ask how he was doing. Susie noted that even with her petite 5'3" frame, she was unable to fully extend her arms and legs. John responded to Susie, "Hey Susie, thanks for coming, but I really want to get out." Over the next few hours, more rescue volunteers in and groups of first responders and different rescue personnel arrived to help figure out how to get John out. But because of his location, they knew that this was extremely difficult to rescue him, and they brainstormed a variety of different options and a variety of different ideas, including using 6 gallons of oil as lube. And they quickly shot this idea down because they recognized he was in a downward slope, which meant that it would run down.
It could have gotten in his nasal passages or in his, like, mouth. He could have suffocated just from the oil.
Yeah, that. And, you know, once they started moving him, if they lost their grip on him.
Oh, he would have slid further.
Yeah, there's no friction stopping him.
Well, and it even kind of terrifies me. Like, I understand why Susie put the ankle wraps on. But, I mean, if you really get stuck, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'd rather have my life saved than my ankle, you know, worry about my ankles. But I feel like you could do some damage tugging somebody up just by their ankles.
We're gonna...
Oh, we're getting there.
No spoilers.
No spoilers. Oh, no. Can't wait now. I have a feeling I'm going to need a brown bag by the end of this. Just brown bag it over here while you finish telling me this story.
So Susie tried to help John shift positions so that way he might be able to help assist himself in getting out, but she wasn't strong enough to move him. She also stretched a water bottle down to his right arm, which was the one that was forced back behind him, and was able to try to get water to flow down his arm and towards his mouth so that way he could at least get something to drink. In an attempt to give them a little bit more traction, she cut his pants off and then joked that she would be the first one to tell his wife what she had done and that she would get them pancakes when he got out of there. Everyone from the get-go was really positive with him that they would get him out, and I think that was a mentality thing, because once you start to doubt that and lose hope, it's downhill from there.
Yeah, I can see that being a good play in most situations. I mean, obviously, you want to hope for the best and plan for the worst, but when the person's actually stuck, you have to keep them calm.
Yeah, and she was very optimistic that they were going to laugh about this someday. About this time, rescuers began drilling to John from another tunnel, but quickly realized this option wasn't a good fit as they only penetrated a couple of inches of rock after more than an hour passed. They had been hoping that they would be able to drill through and break away the rock and access him this way.
That seems all sorts of dangerous too, because what if you shift the rock and he ends up losing his air supply?
Or you shift the rock and everything collapses, and then at that point, you're endangering the rescuers too.
Which, don't get me wrong, I'm not a rescue team expert, and so I'm sure that, you know, somebody would listen to this podcast and be like, you guys are idiots. But, you know, you do whatever you have to in order to get somebody out. Totally get it. But sitting here in the safety of my dining room, you know, you think about all these things. Like, I see why you tried that, but man, there's lots of risks in you trying that.
From what I understand, most rescue organizations are team save as many people possible while putting as few at risk as possible.
Oh, for sure.
Among the complications that were making this rescue particularly difficult were the fact that, as I mentioned, these passages are only several inches to maybe a foot wide, so it's really, really difficult to maneuver in, because the rescuers are already having to contort themselves to get into these spaces, but this particular section also had that little lip on the entrance of the downward part that makes the opening into that downward tunnel smaller.
Which, if you expand on the other side of it, means you have to decompress yourself again to get out of it.
Yeah, decompress and contort yourself at the same time.
the layout of this particular passage that he was in allowed his feet and shins to kind of poke up out of that downward space, but his knees didn't come above that lip, which made made it really hard for everyone to grasp that his legs would probably have to be broken in order to get him out.
Oh, gosh.
Clearly, the rescuers were trying to avoid this and searching for a better way. And this was an extremely difficult decision that they pondered, because if they broke his legs, they feared that he would die from the shock. And doctors and paramedics were at the scene, so they decided to have medicine ready to give to him as soon as he was free.
So they were actually thinking that they were going to break his legs in order to get him out.
They were intending to break his legs, yes.
Wow.
There was an article that went in pretty deep about why they wouldn't just knock John out prior to breaking his legs. And it essentially came down to them having to, or having no way to monitor or control his vitals.
Well, yeah, because once his legs are broken, they still have to pull him out. So, I mean, what are they going to latch him to? Like, what, how would you even anchor him to pull him out? Oh my gosh, can you imagine having your legs broken and then somebody tugging on them to get you out of a small space?
Nope.
Because it's not like you could break him and then somebody just reaches down and like grabs him by the hips and pulls him out or something. Like,
no.
He'd be attached by the ankles, so he would have had to go through an excruciating amount of pain to get out of there. He probably would have passed out on the way.
Probably, which would either have saved his life or
caused major damage. Yeah. I do not envy first responders in these types of situations.
No.
Not at all.
Thank you to all our first responders that are listening, because oh my gosh, you have amazing jobs.
You guys are rock stars. Thank you for taking care of all of us who are sitting here like, nope, that wouldn't be me.
Who only attempt mildly crazy things.
At the most.
At the most.
At this time, they decided to try using ropes that went through a series of pulleys that were attached to the cave walls to allow rescuers in the large room at the bottom of the big slide to pull on the rope and be able to pull him free. The pulleys would have to be specifically placed and then drilled into the rock, so they started this extremely time-consuming process. Outside of the cave were Emily, John's parents, 137 rescuers, volunteers, emergency service personnel, and a helicopter, all waiting for John to be freed. Being upside down means that your heart is having to work extra hard to pump blood out of your brain, and the lungs begin to collect with fluid. And the heart has to work extra hard to pump blood to vital organs. And in short, being upside down for extended periods of time means that your heart has to work too hard and your brain has too much fluid in it. And before long, your system starts to begin to fail. Trauma physician Doug Murdoch was on scene.
And knowing that blood and fluids would be pooling in John's brain and his lung capillaries would begin to burst, and this would leak toxins into John's body, and these toxins would quickly go to his heart and his head and kill him. Additionally, the extra blood pooling in his head would put pressure on his brain, making it more difficult for him to not only process what was happening, but later have control over his body. Dr. Murdoch estimated that rescuers had 8 to 10 hours to free John and get him back onto some sort of horizontal plane before his body would begin to shut down.
So he was saying that he had 8 to 10 more hours?
Yes.
Was John still talking at this point?
Yes.
Wow. Was Susie still in the channel?
Susie switched places with a rescuer named Ryan who would spend the most time with John.
Wow.
While setting up the pulley system, a radio was able to be lowered in just enough that John could talk to Emily, and they spoke and prayed together, and then it was time for the rescuers to start pulling. So they wrapped the ropes around John's ankles, and then every time they pulled the rope, if there wasn't enough power or they weren't at the right angle, they would have to stop and add another pulley. In total, they ended up with 15 pulleys, and each of these pulleys took around an hour to install. So they did an initial installation of several pulleys at one time. And then, as needed, they went back and added more. And this adding the more pulleys was the more time-consuming part.
Hopefully they changed their protocol to add more pulleys the first time. Because how many hours do you think that took just to get the pulleys installed?
Several hours.
Gracious.
Yeah. After 19 hours, they finally had a complete system in place and they were having success. A 8-man team that included Susie in the large cavern were pulling and had to pause frequently because John's legs were in so much pain from the lack of blood flow. So think like the pins and needles sensation, but on steroids.
This is the part of the story that I wasn't looking forward to about hearing him actually getting pulled.
On the third pull, John was high enough that he was able to look up and see rescuer Ryan Schultz. And at this point, Ryan was able to stretch a tube down to John so that way he was able to get water and Gatorade. And Ryan was really just, you know, there to be moral and emotional support for John and let him know that he wasn't alone. My intro is a conversation between John and Ryan. John and Ryan talked extensively about John's family and learned that John's son was due on Ryan's birthday.
Aww.
Ryan talked John through moments of panic where he thrashed violently in the rock, and they prayed together often. Ryan admits he cried more than once, especially when he held the radio down to John so that way he could talk to Emily. And then back in the cavern, the team of eight pulled again and suddenly fell back at the same time, and they heard a painful shout erupt from the cave. They had no idea what happened until Ryan came crawling from the hole with blood all over his face. The pulley that was at the opening of the passage John was stuck in broke away from the cave wall and basically went directly into Ryan's face.
Oh, gosh.
And just because I saw multiple notes about this in my research, they wanted it to be clear that the pulley did not fail. It was the rock. The rock and the clay that had broken and wasn't strong enough to hold the pulley. And in addition to this, they realized that the momentum of John's body falling because of the pulley breaking resulted in him getting lodged farther into the tunnel than he had originally been.
So he's still vertical?
Yes.
Gracious.
It is estimated that the width of this passage now where he was at was only 8.5 inches wide.
Oh my gosh.
Ryan had several facial injuries, including a potential broken jaw. His eyes started to swell shut and his tongue was split almost in half. And also his upper lip was swelling so bad that it like kind of drooped down to his chin. When Ryan met the pulling crew, which included his father, he asked his dad to go down to be with John because he was insisting that somebody needed to go be with him immediately.
Wow.
When Ryan's dad, Dave, arrived, he noticed that John began having some breathing issues and decided that pulling from the legs was no longer the best option and crawled in as deep as he could to wrap a rope around John's waist. While doing this, Dave himself got stuck.
Oh, no.
And once he wiggled free, he began to drill a new area for the pulley. Exhausted, Dave left the cave and was replaced by Brandon Kowalis, but when Brandon arrived, he was unable to get a response from John at all. Shortly after this, a paramedic climbed in to check for a pulse, and they declared John dead at 11:57 p.m., November 25th, 2009. After a harrowing 27 hours of work trying to free him, his determined cause of death is suffocation and cardiac arrest.
Oh my gosh.
Initially, the following morning, which was Thanksgiving Day, attempts were made to remove John's body from the cave, but ultimately, because of rigor mortis and the already difficult to access location John was in, it was decided not to put any more people at risk, and the cave would be John's grave.
Wow.
After a week of deliberations on whether they would just seal the passage specifically or if they were going to seal the entire cave closed, the entire cave was closed to the public and the opening was sealed shut with a cement plug. A plaque in memory of John was placed at the entrance by his family. And then on June 15th, 2 days after his due date, Emily gave birth to their baby boy and named him John. And I want to give a real quick side note that Emily does do an interview at a later date and really touched on grief and how it is different person to person. And she discussed how everyone told her to just give it a year. And she did. And then she still didn't have any movement with healing after that first year, and ultimately knew that healing would come through in her faith and relationship with God.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really touching reminder that grief is individual and not only to that person, but also to the circumstances, your relationship to the person who died, when they died, how they died. It all plays a role, and no one else can dictate how you process your grief.
Yeah. Like I said, it sounds like a cool family. Well, and even the father-son team, Ryan and his dad.
Yeah.
I mean, how cool that they're both on cave rescue.
Yeah.
How do you even get signed up for something like that? I can definitely see it, especially if that's like your hobby and so you're a volunteer rescuer going through the training process.
Yeah.
That way, you know, if you ever get stuck out there, you know that there's trained people to help you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the people that are brave enough to do the caving, I mean, it could be a really cool experience. Like I said, I've been in some of the big ones, you know, that there's not very many tight spaces. And those ones are fun. But I just can't see myself going through Nutty Putty, if I'm being perfectly honest.
Yeah.
See, that's what I mean. Like the 6-foot opening with the slide and it opens up to a big room, like I could keep going down the mudslide. That's fine. It's the small tunnels. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that, I don't think those fit my fancy.
Thank you, Anne, for doing this with me.
For sure. This was fun. Yeah. We made it through bagless.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. Please take a moment to rate and subscribe from wherever you listen to Tragedy with a View. To get access to ad-free episodes, bonus content, and more, please join us on our Patreon. The link will be in the show notes. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And to share a story of your own, send us a campfire confessional email at tragedywithaview@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.